force person. And I might just share this with you, that I can't remember the name of the city, but it was a city that had a large oil supply, reservoirs. And we had bombed that city. And when we came now these hours later and were marching through, going on up north, little children just everywhere. And they would dart out from behind those pieces of buildings and out of the holes where they were living. And they would dart out dirty, and they would spit at us and would curse us. And then they would disappear into the shadows. And I discovered the reason they hated us so. When we bombed that city, those large oil reservoirs were set aflame. And that burning oil poured into the underground air raid shelter. And 20,000 people were burned alive in one of those shelters. And so many of the children were left orphans, and they despised. I've often thought about that. They are adults today. They hated American, especially the American Air Force. So something, when you win a war, you still lose something. We moved on up, and different experiences, but bypassed those. Came to Foggia, Italy. Foggia was one of the main aerial hubs of the German army. There were several, Foggia, Maine was the main airport, but there were several airports around Foggia. And so the Germans were determined to hold that at all costs. And so it cost us a real price to eventually take over that airport. And we moved in to Foggia eventually and set up our tents and encampment and dug the trenches, and some German soldiers infiltrated that area, and they killed some of our men. And so we were not sure at all. There was some degree of confusion among, for some reason, I never discovered why, but among the leadership of the encampment. There was some confusion about security and so on, and so another sergeant and I, we just sort of took it upon ourselves to go out and see just what was the situation and what kind of security we had and so on. And because our tent happened to be out on the in the area where some of our men had been killed, and so this morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, we were out skirting through that area, looking it over. It was my mother's birthday, November the 12th. And Sergeant Duncan, one of the close friends of mine, had walked ahead about 50 or 60 yards perhaps, and all of a sudden, I was caught in a tremendous explosion. And just that quick. And some thought it was a mine, some thought it was a combination, booby trap and mine and so on. Anyway, all I know is, I was caught in a tremendous explosion. And, of course, my left hand was blown away. A portion of my right hand was blown off. My right leg was severely injured. Had a piece of shrapnel that hit me in the right chest. It went into the bone and stopped. If it had gone through, I'd have been killed immediately. And had so many multiple wounds all over my body. And I was blind for about 2 weeks. But I was never unconscious. When something like that happens to you, your body is plunged into deep shock. And I used to wonder about that, but I understand it now. The body protecting itself. So anyway, I went into a deep shock, and a Jeep had just stopped. That Jeep had not have been there, I probably would have died right at that place. And I don't even know who the person was or why he was there. But anyway, he just stopped, and the explosion occurred. And I could hear those men in the background, And they picked me up and put me in that Jeep, but I never felt their arms under my body. My body was totally numb from shock. And I heard the revving of the Jeep and taking off of British Hospital, which was probably about 2 miles away. And what do you suppose a person in that condition would think about? In my condition, I wasn't sure I was saved. And all the way to that hospital, I pled with the Lord, "Oh Lord, if I'm not saved, save me now. If I'm not saved, save me now." And then I saw that porch while we were on the way to that hospital. I saw that porch scene in my hometown where I made the decision that I would not walk with the Lord. We got to the hospital and they carried me in, and I'd been in the hospital maybe 15 minutes, and that shock began to subside. The shock began to go away, and I have a pretty high tolerance of pain, but the pain was so severe that I couldn't take it. And I smelled the perfume, and so I knew a nurse was standing there, blind and couldn't see, and so I said to her, "Could I have something for pain?" And so they gave me a couple of shots, and after that, I'm sure I was taken to the operating room. I'm not sure how long I was in the operating room with so many multiple wounds I had. And anyway, and they started to remove the left eye, they told me later, and decided not to. And so I woke up whatever time later, and of course when you're blind, day and night is the same. And I began 2 weeks of tottering between life and death. And in that darkness, pleading with the Lord, "Oh Lord, let me live. I'll do anything you ask me to do if you'll just let me live." But I figured it was too late. I did a lot of weeping in those days. The bandages on my eyes were continually wet with tears, pleading with the Lord, pleading with the Lord. "Let me live. Let me live." I knew I didn't deserve it. I knew that I was the one that had rebelled against the Lord. I knew that I was the one who, in essence, had said, "It's fine for you to save me. I'm just not going to serve you." And so that went on for, that was in Foggia, went on for about two weeks. And death was so close in those days. I don't know whether you're going to understand this or not, but death was so close I could touch it with my hand. It's like a black tidal wave just rolling in upon me, suffocating, driving life out of my body, and then it would recede. And a little while later, the same thing, the tidal wave of death coming in upon me. And the telegram my mother received was to prepare her for my death. They didn't expect me to live. And I might just share this. One of those days, after I'd been there, I suppose, about a week, the doctor and I guess a nurse, anyway, a man and a woman standing beside my bed on the left, and they were talking. There was a shortage of beds, and they were looking for spaces to put other beds and beds that were empty. And the doctor, apparently thinking I was unconscious, said, "Well, this bed will be empty probably tomorrow." He's talking about me. And that was comforting. But anyway, began to wrestle with that, the prospect of meeting the Lord, and I wasn't ready to meet him. He was all but a total stranger to me. And I was not ready to meet him. So I kept pleading and kept pleading. And dear friends, right in the middle of that midnight darkness, the light came on. That's the only way I can describe it. Up until that moment, my whole life had just been flooded with darkness. Darkness, darkness, deepening darkness. And now in the midst of that midnight, the light came on. And I knew that I was going to live. No one told me. I knew that I was going to live. But what I did not know, across those thousands of miles back in that little town, my hometown, there were a group of 6 or 8 godly women. One of them was a widow lady, a Baptist pastor's wife, Mrs. Dodd, and so loved the Lord. I had met her as a young person. And Mrs. McCallum, so loved the Lord. Methodist preacher's wife, Mrs. Carroll, loved the Lord. And they knew how to pray. And they went to my mother and they said, "We don't believe the Lord is finished with your son. So we have covenanted together to pray until the Lord spares his life." And dear friends, that light that burst through into my dark world was God answering the prayers of those dear women. He heard their prayers, not mine. And he answered their prayers, and he gave me a second chance. I spent about a couple of more weeks in that hospital and was sent to Bari, Italy, to another British hospital, and been there about 3 or 4 days, and the German planes came over one night and they bombed Bari, Italy, and bombed the hospital. Doors came flying through the ward where I was. Windows came flying through and all kind of debris. And death was very close again. By the way, when that happened, all over that ward, men started praying out loud. All over that ward, men started praying, crying out loud that God would have mercy. Was there for a couple of 3 weeks and then got orders to go back to the first American hospital in Algiers in North Africa, 43rd General Hospital, and checked in the hospital and was there for about 3 months. Did several operations and I might share this with you. I've shared this at different times. It's just sort of one of those sideline stories. While I was in that hospital, I met a little French girl, Chantal Chambert. She was 11 years old. I was then 19. And her father had been a Canadian from Canada, and he had married her mother, who was a French woman, and they had 3 children. Chantal was the oldest. And he was in the army in the early stages of the war between Germany and France. He was killed. And so Chantal's mother and with the 3 children escaped to North Africa, French Morocco. And she took a job in the hospital there in Algiers, and Chantal, because of having a Canadian father, spoke very good English. And so she would come into the hospital ward and visit and talk and just came back ever so often. And it happened that in that particular ward, the ward was a tent, large tent, and it happened in that particular ward, I happened to be the most severely wounded in that, not in the hospital, but in that particular ward. And so I guess Chantal felt sorry for me, so she spent more of her time by my bed talking with me and became very well acquainted and enjoyed talking with her. very intelligent little girl. And I was there during Christmas. And early Christmas morning, I saw the flap of that tent open, and there was the outline of this little girl. And she came into the hospital ward and came over by my bed, and she had been crying. She stood there for a little bit. We wished each other Merry Christmas, and she had her hands behind her back. And she said, "I wanted to buy you something for Christmas, but I didn't have any money." That little girl had had a crush on me, apparently, I discovered later. And anyway, she said, "So I didn't have any money, so I brought you this." And she brought her hands out and pitched on my bed an orange. There was an orchard out by the hospital, and she'd gone to the orchard and pulled an orange off of one of the trees, and that was her Christmas gift to me. And she said, "This is all I have," and she pitched it on the bed, and then she burst out crying and ran out the door. The last time I saw Chantal, loaded in an army ambulance to be taken away to the hospital ship to come home, and there that little frail girl was standing at the back door of that ambulance, waving and wiping away the tears. I spent, as I mentioned, about 3 months in that hospital. Went through several operations, and then the army nurse, freckled-faced, slender woman, 35, I'd say, years of age, came to the foot of my bed, and she said, "Are you Boydston?" I said, "Yes, I am." "Harry Boydston?" I said, "Right. Serial number so-and-so." And you know, "That's right." She said, "Well, Boydston, you're going home." And I have shared this with you before, but I cannot tell you how going home just completely devastated me. I was overcome with weeping and rejoicing at the same time. A few days later, I was loaded onto the hospital ship Arcadia, and we spent the 11 days trip across the ocean to Charleston, South Carolina. Landed at Charleston, South Carolina on March the 18th of that year. And I'll never forget the longing to be home, the longing to see home. And when we began to get close to the shoreline, I can still see those soldiers who were confined to bed, get out of the bed, crawl over to the wall and ask a guy to pull them up so they could look through the porthole to see the land of America. It took a while, quite a while, to unload the ship, and men were carried down that gangplank, men without legs, some with one leg, some on crutches, some with one arm, some with two, no arms. Some of them were blind, had to be led by someone else. All kinds of injuries. The most severely, I thought, were those who had been burned, caught in chemical fires or whatever, sometimes in a plane crash. Severely burned, some of them were, and it was a very trying sight to look at those men who were so disfigured. Came down the gangplank, and by being carried down that gangplank, I saw those men down on the ground, kissing the ground, crying like little children, and beating the ground with their fists and talking about. I'm home. I'm home. The American band was playing the song we sang this morning, My Country 'Tis of Thee, Sweet Land of Liberty. And then they began to play Home Sweet Home. Every little shack along that waterfront looked like a mansion. I never expected to see America again when I was in Foggia, Italy, in that hospital. And so finally I was home. There's a large hospital there in Charleston that is a staging area for dispensing the soldiers, the patients, according to whatever is their injury. Those in my case were sent to orthopedic hospitals, and some were blind, some were burned, and so on. So they're dispensed to the different hospitals in America. America had different regional hospitals, army hospitals in those days that took care of certain kind of patients. So I was assigned to Bushnell Hospital in Ogden, Utah. Got on a army train and traveled those days to Ogden, Utah. Spent 8 months in that hospital, went through a number of operations at that hospital, and I might just share this with you. The victims of war are, sometimes their plight is indescribable. In the ward where I was, there was a young man. He was about the size of Jeff Holdridge. And I noticed he was always by himself. No one had anything to do with him. And I also noticed that he was assigned to a room where there were bars over the windows. So I asked the Army nurse, I said, ask about him, and she told me. He was a young man who was afraid of war and was afraid to go overseas. So when he was given his orders that he was being shipped overseas, he took an Army 45 pistol, and put it under his chin, and pulled the trigger. If he'd had it pointed straight up, it would have killed him immediately, but a 45 pistol makes quite a hole. But it was angled, and so it came out the front part of his face, blew out all of his tongue, blew out the roof of his mouth, blew off his nose, went right between his eyes, and blew off part of his skull. He had tried to commit suicide. I introduced myself to him, and I said, I'd like to be your friend. Told him I was from Oklahoma and so on, and maybe we could eat together or whatever. And for most of the conversation, he wouldn't try to talk. Well, I didn't know his tongue was gone, and he couldn't talk. He just makes sort of a garbling sound. I could not understand anything he was trying to say. And he finally became embarrassed and turned away. I'm sure he later took his life. But he was intent on, he had jumped out of the second story window trying to take his life prior to that. That's why the bar was over the window. And in that same hospital ward, I'll just share this thing with you, help you see a little bit of some of the things that happened. Very, very difficult for men who had wives at home, and the wives had never seen them since they'd been injured, and now they're back in the States. And I'd see those wives come in to the ward, and Some of them just fainted when they saw their husband. And some of them would stop and begin weeping. The husband would have to go to them. Others would just run across the world and fall upon the husband's neck. Very difficult, difficult time, especially the men who were burned, so horribly disfigured. In the ward where I was, one of the young men, his name was Terry. He had was in the artillery. He was loading a 155-meter shell into the breech, and it exploded. It blew off both of his arms. Both of his arms were off above the elbow. Had some other facial and upper body injuries. His face looked like it was filled with black freckles, powder burned, and just covered completely. His eyes also. And one of the nurses came to us one day and said, you need to do something about Terry. He's going to kill himself. He doesn't want to live. And so I was in bed and couldn't go, and two or three of the other guys said, we'll take care of him. And one of these guys was sort of obnoxious anyway, and he enjoyed pulling jokes on people. And so Terry came down the aisle right by my bed and had on his army pajamas, those two loose sleeves, those empty sleeves dangling by his side. And this guy on the other side walked out and says, Terry, want to get acquainted with you. And he went right up in front of him, and Terry said, get out of my way. And he bumped his shoulder into him, and the guy said, hey, Terry, I want to be your friend. He said, I don't want a friend. He said, I'm going to be your friend anyway. And then another guy and a couple other guys came, and they said, we want to be your friend too. So they took hold of his pajamas and holding him there, and he was twisting and throwing those empty sleeves, popping it, trying to pop it in their face. Anyway, they said, Terry, we want to be your friend. And he really cussed. Anyway, they took him out. There were poles in that hospital ward, like back in Fellowship Hall, and they took him over to one of those poles, and they took those sleeves, and they wrapped them around those poles and took them around his back and tied it, those two sleeves, right in the middle of his back. And there he was. He couldn't go anywhere. Of course, he was cussing all this time and trying to get loose, and he couldn't get loose. And finally, he managed to slip out of that upper part of his pajamas and left it hanging on the pole. When he got out of it, these three guys ran to him and took the pajamas, and they said, here, we'll help you get back in your pajamas. So that went on for some time. Different things. They would short sheet his bed. You know what that is? See me later. But anyway, do different things to aggravate him. Made him mad. But let me say this. In a period of about 2 months, month and a half maybe, they were able to break through the crust. And Terry became a very likable person. And it broke him out of that shell, and he no longer considered taking his life. So that's just a little bit of a sidelight of hospital life. I was sent down to the prosthetic ward one day to get fitted for